Hello, and welcome to Sounding Out with Izzy, the podcast where we have conversations with musicians, music producers, publicists, live promoters, zine makers, journalists, and more about their experiences working in the music industry as women, non-binary, and queer people. I'm your host, Isabel Korp, the founder of the queer femme music-based blog and YouTube channel, A Girl's Two Sound Sense. On today's episode, I am joined by writer, music enjoyer, journalist, and chronically online tweeter, Grace Robin Somerville, whose writing can be found in The Alternative, Salvation South, Merry-Go-Round, Paste, and more. Grace and I discuss a number of topics, including the proliferation of hot girl literature on Book Talk, our favorite late 2000s radio pop cuts from Cascada to Edward Maya, and why her favorite writers of all time are the writers who blend the critical with the intensely personal. And without further ado, let's get right into this episode. Grace, welcome to Sounding Out with Izzy.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much for agreeing to talk to me. For those of you who might not know, I am now speaking with Grace Robin Somerville, whose work you may have seen in Merry-Go-Round, Swim Into Sound, and Paste magazine. You might also know her as Wrestle with Jimmy Coco Puff on Twitter. Welcome. And why don't you tell me a little about what's going on in your life at the present moment? I noticed you're currently back in school, so I would love to know a little more about that.
Yeah, so I am currently in my second year of a three-year MFA program at University of North Carolina, Wilmington. I'm living down in Wilmington now and basically working towards a thesis that I'll turn in about a year from now, which is going to be an essay collection. And I also am teaching. I'm teaching publishing classes to undergraduates at the university and working in the UNCW Publishing Lab. And I'm also just kind of writing here and there, doing like freelance stuff for Paste, The Alternative, Salvation South. So yeah, kind of hands in many pots right now.
Very many indeed, yeah. How do you find it is being on the other side of teaching the undergraduates?
Well, I've actually been like taking the grad version of the publishing class that I have been teaching kind of alongside while I'm teaching it, which is weird. And it's a lot of learning on the fly, but I really love teaching. This is my first time teaching at a college level. And like, you know, I've taught mostly like younger kids before. So it's very cool to be teaching like something so high, like so specific. And so, you know, at the level that it is, it's also kind of weird because since I'm teaching publishing classes, it's almost like I'm teaching a business class because a lot of it is talking about like the business of being a writer and the various like jobs that go into making a book and bringing it from like the manuscript on the desk to the hardcover or paperback in a bookstore or library or whatever. But yeah, it's very scary, but it's very fulfilling. And I feel like I learn a lot from it every day, honestly. And I'm just glad that I get to teach something that is so relevant to what I do and what I want to do.
Yeah, I'm sure. And I mean, like with publishing, how do you find like at what frequency the industry and the practices change? Because like, for example, like my field is in mostly social media. And so, you know, with all platforms, it's updating at least every 2 weeks, if not in a shorter time span. So how would you say the publishing industry changes and what's the rate like?
That is a very good question, a big question, and definitely depends on like what level you're working at. you know, whether you're working with small presses, which like I do a lot of work with the small press that's housed in my university, or if you're working with like a big five publisher where you've got like way more hands on deck and like usually a much bigger budget. And I feel like it's definitely changed a lot, like in general, in the past 10 or 20 years, just with the internet becoming as ubiquitous as it is, and like the internet going from like being a place that you go to going to like becoming like a place where everything happens. So yeah, I mean, I feel like it's also constantly changing all the time. Like I interned at a big five publishing house a couple years ago when I was in college. And even then, I felt like the approach to social media was so different from how it is now. And kind of the platforms that people used and the way people marketed books, and even just like the culture surrounding how people do like literary publicity and marketing. Like we didn't have book talk, and it was kind of the advent of like bookstagrammers and like BookTube and stuff like that. And all of that has just really grown exponentially.
Yeah, I can imagine. And what are your thoughts and feelings on like the social mediaification of reading, or the hot, I guess the, I would call it the hot girlification of reading?
I was literally just talking about this with my friend like a couple days ago, I think. My friend who they work in a bookstore and have like a couple years of experience as a bookseller. And I think we both talk about like literary trends a lot. I feel like I have a lot of mixed feelings about it, because I think if we are anything that is getting more people to read young women's writing, especially if it's like really good writing, is a good thing. And anything that is like getting more people to read is a good thing, just in general. But I also like, and this isn't the first time by any means that books have been like a trendy thing or like a status symbol. Like, you know, 150 years ago, that's how it was. It was like, if you were a rich person, you could afford to have books in your home, and you could afford to, you could have the leisure time to read just for pleasure. And now I feel like books, though being like less expensive comparatively, are, and you know, more of a thing that are, you know, a more accessible thing, still a commodity, but I feel like are a status symbol or like a signifier in a different way. And like a lot of times I do question whether the like way that social media has affected literary trends is actually getting people to read more, or if it's just like, because it seems more about like cultivating an identity as someone who reads, or like a certain type of reader, or someone who has a certain type of taste or reads these type of books, than actually reading. It feels more about like what you are than what you do. And I feel like I take some issues with like the hot girl books trend, just because I feel like now there's almost this assumption that like if you are a young female writer, like there's this expectation for you to be very front-facing, for you to have to kind of sell your looks as well as your work, and to be like, to kind of promote yourself as like, in a weird way, almost a sexual object, and be like, oh, well, like, if you're a hot girl, you'll buy my book, or you'll subscribe to my newsletter, or whatever, like, and be kind of, it's usually, the attention is usually on the women who are the, you know, women writers who are embracing this very like hyper feminine, often very sexualized persona, which in and of itself, I don't have a problem with, but I do take issue a little bit with, one, the expectation that female writers should have to do that in order to promote their books, and two, that like, it kind of feels like a lot of times it pulls focus from the work itself. And also like, I feel like has invited, in like the worst context, invited a sort of like really gross like cattiness and shallowness into a lot of literary worlds, like, and it kind of, I feel like it's kind of given people these certain shortcuts to like seeming clever or smart, which is like, it's, you know, this isn't exclusive to literature, but like, it feels like a lot of times they'll have like one person who does this thing really well, and people will take the most shallow aspects of what that person does and try and replicate it, and then the work falls flat. Like, yes, like Eve Babbitt and Joan Didion had this kind of like sharp, a little bit bitchy thing going on, but like, you can't just be like a skinny mean girl in New York and LA and expect to be writing on the level of Joan Didion and Eve Babbitt. Like, it's, you know, I'm also just like not, I think if you're like a hot girl writer, that's fine. But I personally am like, I am a writer first. And if I am feeling hot, I am a hot girl second. And I do think that like under the worst cases, and I'm not saying this absolutely, like, I'm absolutely not saying this about everyone who kind of even a little bit falls into this category, or like every female writer who is also into like playing up her sexuality or being glamorous or being like a party girl. But like, I do sometimes question the validity of it. Like, do you, I think it's totally okay to just like want to be a hot girl and want to, or want to be like a socialite. You don't have to write a book, but like it, I do sometimes, and I like even question myself. I'm like, oh, is this a misogynistic impulse to be like, oh, well, like, is she actually a good writer? Does she actually care about the work? Or like, does she just want to be like, is she just hot and like wants to seem smart? So I don't know. I think obviously there's like a lot of complex feelings about it. And like, I think through a lot of my writing, it's, you know, whether intentional or not, a lot of what I write is like trying to disentangle like ownership over art and the trappings of femininity, and like, how can we, you know, write about womanhood, or write, or as women, just not write about womanhood, but just exist as women and writers in the world, and like have that, you know, and exist as people. So that's my very long-winded answer, which I am trying to be as nuanced as possible about it, just because I think it's such a complicated cultural thing. And also because I don't want the people to be coming in the comments on this episode and being like, oh, well, you're a misogynist and you just hate when women are hot and fun and also write books. Like, no, women should be allowed to be hot and fun and also write books. Like, who cares?
Exactly. Yeah. The TLDR is the hot girliness is a bonus, and yeah, the foundation should be the work. Doesn't hurt if you're hot, though.
Yeah. And I'm like, I think it's also, we've almost reached market saturation of like all the things, all the like things that we say that hot girls do. And it really has kind of just become shorthand for like, oh, buy this thing. Like, oh, well, if you're a hot girl, you'll buy my book. You'll take this medication. You'll eat tinned fish. You'll wear this type of yoga pants or whatever. And it's just like, okay, like how else, we got to think outside the box a little. How else can we define ourselves and find confidence that doesn't come from just like buying shit? And it's like not even about like reading the book. It's about like carrying the book around or like having it kind of peeking out of your tote bag or whatever. So yeah, like we don't like to think of our art or our creative work as a commodity, but like at the end of the day, it is. And I think a question that I grapple with a lot is like, how do I kind of work around that and, or work within it in the way that is like the least soul crushing and comes at the smallest expense of the quality of the work.
Mm-hmm. And so I know that now that you're based in Wilmington, you have noted that being raised in Brooklyn was very different. with respect to live music. So now that you've sort of like been in the Wilmington pool for a while, how would you say, like, how, I don't, like, without like necessarily being so like rushing, sprinting to compare the two, how would you say that you appreciate both cities and their live music scenes differently?
Yeah, I mean, I think sometimes like growing up in New York, especially since I've left, I feel this like weird complex where I'm like, oh, I should be cooler and more interesting than I am because I had all of this cool stuff just at my disposal. And I'm like, oh, well, like if I don't know like about some band or like some book or something, that I'm just like, oh my God, this is a huge gap in my cultural knowledge. How did I not know this? Especially if it's a New York artist or New York writer, I think I get like a weird sense of inferiority about that, because I think it all like, I think it took leaving in a way to realize that in some ways I took that for granted about how immediate everything was. Like if, you know, if a band that I liked was going on tour, I could almost guarantee that they were coming to my city. Whereas now I feel like I'm somewhere where I really have to plan for that stuff and I really have to seek it out, which I has taken a lot of getting used to, but I love Wilmington and I like, I have a really great community here, and there's like a small but very like fun and thriving local scene. And there's, you know, I also will occasionally go to shows in like the Triangle or in like Myrtle Beach or Charlotte. Like just last night I went and saw Echo Astral in Durham, and like, you know, amazing show. I'm so excited for people to hear the record that that band is putting out. They just like, just wonderful band, incredible performance. JL is just electric on stage and is also just such a sweet, kind, brilliant person. You should have her on the podcast, honestly. But there's, I think I realized a little bit more that like, when that stuff doesn't just come to you, you really have to seek it out. And I think I've like expanded my taste even more in weird ways since leaving the city. And like, it's weird because back in New York, like there was kind of an abundance of choices. Like on any given night, there could be like 3-4 shows going on that I would have at least mild interest in. And there's a decent chance that like they would all be free or cheap. But that usually meant I was most likely to go see the band that I was already familiar with. But here it's like, oh, what's happening tonight? Well, these three bands that I've never heard of are playing at a dive bar near me. Could be fun. So yeah, I think it was a very big change, but I think a welcome one. I also saw Home Is Where like last summer. Great show, although I will say that was probably like the smelliest crowd I've ever been in at any concert I've ever gone to. Like, holy hell, that room smelled foul. Oh my God.
I hear that a lot. Like, I interviewed Home Is Where, and Brandon herself was like, oh yeah, that the one at Elsewhere, that was a smelly show.
Oh my God. Oh, I also have their poster literally right behind me, the pink one.
Oh, I love it.
Yeah.
Whaler poster.
Yeah, cute coincidence. But yeah, love Home Is Where.
So as a like fun little other like aside, because since we do talk about music over here, what are three like newer bands that you discovered recently that you have formed your entire personality around as a result?
Very good question. So the first one that immediately comes to mind is Star 99. They are from the Bay Area. They put out their debut album last year. It's called Bitch Unlimited. I first listened to them like a couple weeks before this album came out. And they had a, because my first encounter with them was an EP that was named after a Los Campesinos song. So I was like, okay, I'm already on board. But their album from last year, Bitch Unlimited, was one of my favorites. And it's really short, super easy, fun listen. And it is one of those albums where the cover art just really looks like how it sounds. And it is very like cute, kitschy, like kind of bratty pop punk and power pop. And it's, they're on Lauren Records, which is a label that I really love. And I feel like they kind of are at the intersection of a lot of other bands that I love. And especially like, they remind me of a very specific era of like kind of surf rocky, pop punk adjacent indie rock from like early 2010s. Like I hear a lot of like Kayatana, a lot of Swearin, like a little Joyce Manor, like the early stuff. But yeah, just a really wonderful band that I am constantly singing the praises of. I just really want more people to check them out. And another one that I have gotten really into recently is I really love the last two Liquid Mike records. I had the privilege of reviewing his most recent album for Paste, and it's just like really good, shreddy, short pop rock songs that just like, I feel like I have a different Liquid Mike song stuck in my head every day. And like, especially since the weather has started to get warmer down here, I feel like I am just reaching for like his stuff all the time. And like, he has such a funny origin story where it was just like all of a sudden, like just a real word of mouth rise to popularity, relative popularity. And he's like a mailman, the lead singer. There's just such a like cool mythology behind that band. And then I also want to shout out what is probably my favorite album of the year so far, the new Rosalie album. I just think she's like, she has such an incredible voice, and I love her songwriting. And I this is the first one of her albums that really hooked me. And I think part of that is because she like really expanded her backing band. And it's just like, it's very like kind of, it's kind of a sweet spot between like hold steady type bar band guitar and like, you know, kind of jangly alt country in the vein of like Silver Jews or Songs Ohia. And she has this way of juxtaposing like really gorgeous, like elaborate, dreamy imagery with just like lyricism that is completely on the other end, just super direct, super like concise. And I just love the way she does that, and it feels so seamless. So yeah, I just can't get enough of that album.
I love how you put Rosalie and the hold steady in the same sentence. It makes so much, but it makes total sense though. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So what I really like a lot about your writing is that you are part of a class of writers who I would also put people like Miranda Reinert and Danielle Chalosky in, like young women in their like early to mid 20s who aren't bound by the stiffness of music journalism and not afraid to integrate their thoughts on music with like their actual lives. And you're so good at it too. Is that something that like you have like really aimed for with your work as a whole since the beginning? Or is it something you've kind of grown into?
Kind of both. First of all, it's like an honor to be named among Miranda and Danielle, because I have been reading both of their work for a long time, and I really admire both of them. But I think I sometimes I'll like read my early album reviews, and I kind of cringe a little bit because it's so obvious that I was just kind of trying to write like what I was reading in Pitchfork or Rolling Stone. And I was like, oh, well, this is how a serious music reviewer writes. And I think there's definitely a place for all that. And I think there's some stuff where I'm just like, yeah, this doesn't call for me like bringing in some anecdote about my life. But on the other hand, I think a lot of, when I think of my biggest influences, a lot of them are these writers who are kind of, who kind of view like the critical voice and that personal voice as one and the same, or like where it feels very, you know, they kind of homogenize it and they sort of put the personal narratives and the kind of journalistic stuff on equal footing. You know, I think of writers like Hanif Abdurraqib or Jessica Hopper, where they can kind of slip in and out of the criticism voice so seamlessly that you don't even notice that they're doing something different, where it's like, okay, well, is this like, you know, is this a story about Jessica Hopper, you know, going out one night in Wicker Park in 2006, or is it a story about like the, you know, the Chicago punk scene in the early aughts and a report on like how gentrification affected that? Well, it's both. Or like, I love writers who kind of, they're technically writing about the subject of their criticism, but like not really. Like, you know, how, like I think of someone like Chuck Klosterman, how I'm just like, okay, well, Killing Yourself to Live is technically a book about how he's, you know, driving across the country and visiting the death sites of famous rock stars, but not really. It's really about like him trying to sort out how he feels about various romantic relationships in his life that are at different points, and like trying to grapple with his own mortality and his own like emotional blocks. And I love that. I love using the music as kind of a vessel for something else, or like as a means of being like, okay, well, I'm gonna outsource my own feelings about this other thing to, you know, a discussion about a song or a record or something like that. Or like, you know, I mentioned Hanif Abdurraqib, but like, I think he does that really well, where like there's, I think of his essay about The Weeknd, going to a Weeknd concert, where it's actually an essay about him trying to get over a breakup. Or there's another essay in that same book where he's doing a retrospective on a Wonder Years album, but it's actually about him kind of waxing on the melancholia of the suburbs and like analyzing other people's grief up against his own. So yeah, I think that I like seeing the ways that, you know, a piece of art can unlock these little worlds for people. Or like, even if it's, especially if, I think it's a bonus if it's, you know, a song or artist or album or band or whatever that I enjoy, because I can be like, oh, that's cool getting to see this, that it has these personal connections to this writer that I never thought of before because I'd never lived their life. But even if it's, you know, an artist that I don't really follow or like care about that much, or even like, I have tons of music writing that's like people talking about their connections to artists that like, I'm like, I don't really get them, but like, I want to hear your story. And I want you to like, make me care about this, or make me care about something adjacent to this. And I think like, if you can manage to do that, that's no small feat.
It's really true. And it really speaks to the really like insurmountable power and grip that a medium of art like music has on everybody just navigating the world, and how that can affect the way they navigate the world and grapple with things like mortality and grief. And what other art form like does that? Like, I mean, like perhaps like if I read like a poem that really resonates with me, like I might get like a similar reaction, but like when it's all encompassing, like the words and the chords and like all the harmonics locking in, I mean, if that doesn't get you excited, what does, right?
Yeah. I think that's definitely like part of why. And I feel like I write about other art forms or like will kind of weave them in. And I like doing that. But I think that's part of why music is sort of my main one, just because I feel like the connection there is so immediate and it's so direct. Like, I don't know, I think there's few other things that can do that. And like, when there's, you know, when I can find like a piece of visual art or a poem or like a book or a movie that hits me the same way that like a really good song or a really good album does, I feel like that really sticks out to me. And that's, I think that's why I also like, I think when I read, I like tend to gravitate a lot towards authors who are sort of have that musicality to them, or like have, you know, their book is kind of mimicking the structure of an album, or like maybe not consciously mimicking, but like kind of has that feeling to it where it feels like, oh, this is like, I don't know, I think of like Pop Song by Larissa Pham, one of my favorite books. And the whole time I was reading it for the first time, I was like, wow, this is, it feels like she has made me a mixtape with this book of essays. And it was kind of mind blowing the way that it was sort of hitting, like kind of like an album or a playlist would. I just think that's so cool, that kind of cross media thing that happens, and when it does happen, it's really special.
Yeah, it really is. And like going back to what you said earlier about how you want to hear from people who are really, really devoted to artists that you might not get, but you want to like be persuaded as to why they click with people. Like, I just recently made a video on my top 10 songs that were in the OC. And like, my goal with that was to really illustrate like how incredible and pioneering and how underestimated that their music supervisor was, and how genius, like the long game they played with these needle drops of certain songs was used as effective narrative devices for the story. And like that was my goal. I wanted to make someone who was like, really, the OC, the show that pioneered The Hills and The Real Housewives of Orange County. Like, I wanted to make that person go like, huh, maybe I'll give it a watch, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love that. And I've never seen The OC, but like, I feel like that's come up in conversations that I've had about like, we don't really get the like, real life band performs on a TV show thing anymore. Like, it's the characters in the TV show are like, hey, we're all gonna go to the Fall Out Boy concert tonight. Are they the ones who performed on the OC? Or maybe they were in like some other show.
I think that was One Tree Hill. One Tree Hill, right, was the one where Pete Wentz stayed over at Peyton's house. Like, that was weird. That was real weird.
Yeah. Or like, I think Yola Tango was on Gilmore Girls or something, but like, I think we as a culture have kind of, we need to go back. I'm going to be like a return guy, but for like the real life band playing on a TV show and like the characters being fans of them in universe. But like, that's the kind of thing that I love to read where I'm like, I would have never thought like, I'm going to go Google to see if someone has written about the music on the OC, because why would that occur to me as someone who's never watched the show? But like, I love finding the thing that I didn't know I wanted.
Yeah, for sure. And it's so interesting, like knowing just like all the technicalities and the logistics of like filming something like a band playing on a show, because they're never playing live. They have to lip sync to track in those shots, which is something that I learned recently, but it's very interesting. Like, I just love like getting to know like the nitty gritty details of like, I don't know, like a field like film production with that I don't work in. I think it's interesting.
Absolutely. Like, I even love, like, I think part of what I've loved so much about writing about music is learning about like the job of being a musician, or even not even just musicians, but like, you know, all of the people who work in the music industry and like who come together to make this stuff happen. And like, there's so many people doing really cool, interesting work. And I, you know, I love being able to find out like the inner workings of these jobs, many of which I will probably never do. But I don't know, it gives everything so much more context.
Yeah, absolutely. And speaking of people doing like that amazing work, shout out to Yuma. I went to a Yuma showcase last night. Yola Tango and Slaughter Beach Dog co-headlined, and the Ophelias also played. It was incredible. But a big thing that a lot of people really don't get, because a lot of people see the glamour of it and it being like a sexy job, but the reality is that a lot of us like are not getting paid what we're worth. Whether you're an artist, whether you're an engineer, whether you're a digital marketer like me, but like what's really cool is like I really love living in a moment where speaking out against like injustice in these situations and these work environments in the arts, because it is a big problem and has been for a very, very long time.
Definitely.
And yeah, do you follow Yuma on socials?
I don't think so, but I did see that show, and I didn't see it, but I saw a lot of people talking about it, and I was like, oh, that looks so cool. I wish I could have gone.
Yeah, I legit like I had this that was my first time actually seeing Slaughter Beach Dog,
So great.
and they're just beasts. That was like I was transfixed. I was locked in the entire time. Like I was getting work texts and ignoring them throughout the whole set.
I love them. I have been a fan for so long, and they're one that I have like such a special, like sentimental place in my heart for. The first time I saw them live, I saw them and Oceanator open for Jeff Rosenstock. And I, you know, having just going to a show, like great band, but you're having a terrible night. That was kind of what was going on. I was just like feeling very physically ill. And like just so anxious and having it manifest like bodily. And I like towards the end of that show, I like had to go throw up. It was awful. But I remember watching Slaughter Beach Dog and freaking out because at the time I had like a huge crush on this guy from Twitter. And I was kind of realizing that, and I was like, oh fuck, like this is so stupid. What am I gonna do? And then the next time I saw Slaughter Beach Dog, my Twitter crush and I had met multiple times and had started dating and had bonded over this band. And I was like, oh, this is very sweet. Like, look how far we've come. We're gonna go see them together. And it was so they're just like such a special one for me. And they always put on such a great live show.
Is your Twitter crush the person you're currently dating?
Yes. Still my
Congratulations.
Twitter crush, still the person I'm currently dating.
That is
And
so
yeah.
sweet. I
Yeah.
love that. Oh my God.
Which is also just like both of us are music writers, both of us like very nerdy about music and very like obsessive and weird about the music we like. And like I think for a long time that was something that I was like really embarrassed by, where someone would be like, oh, do you like so and so band? And then I'd be like, oh my God, yes. And then I would just start like rabbit holing and talking about all this lore about them and want to really go deep. And someone was like, oh yeah, I like them too. And I felt like weird about, I was like, okay, like even if it's a cool band to like, and like this isn't even touching the bands that I like that are like admittedly not cool to like, but like even if it was a cool band, I would just be like, oh, am I liking this in an uncool way, or am I being like too much about it? Am I like, you know, just being too much of a nerd and like being too obsessive and too dedicated? And I think, and that was kind of one of the first things he and I bonded over, where like we were both very passionate and very kind of like dorky and analytical about the things we really liked, particularly music. And that was kind of it felt like, and still feels like, this we have this kind of special language that we can speak with each other. So that was always like, you know, that's been very affirming, both like in our relationship and in the work that both of us do.
Yeah. Speaking of quote unquote, like cool or uncool bands, do you subscribe to the notion of guilty pleasures and certain things having a shelf life, or do you not have any reservations or guilt about stuff that you like?
I wish I didn't. I feel like I think there's like different categories of like guilty pleasure stuff. I think I've said this before, and I think when I first said it, I like didn't really believe it, but the more I've thought about it, I believe it. Like it started as a joke, but now it's very much not. But I'm kind of the mind that like something doesn't have to be good for me to like it. I think there's a difference between like things that are bad in a fun way and things that are just bad. Like, I don't know, I feel like I'm blanking on everything right now, but I feel like there's a lot of like really trashy, like badly aged pop punk from the 2000s that I will still enjoy on occasion, or like guilty pleasures as in like I know the whole like canceled artists thing is like a huge can of worms to get into, and I feel like I have no concrete answer for like what to do when you like the art made by people who in their non-artistic lives do horrendous things. But like there's definitely, I was saying this recently, I was like, sometimes it is easier for me to still listen to like a quote unquote canceled artist if their music isn't that good, which sounds so counterintuitive. Like, you know, if it's music that I think is really brilliant and that like was really important to me at a certain time that I really resonated with, it can be harder to reconcile that, where I'm just like, oh, like, I don't know, because this loomed so large in my life and was so, so significant, it almost feels worse to know the horrible things that person did. Whereas like, there's tons of like really shitty, like emo bands from the 2010s that like are, you know, so canceled, or like, you know, everyone knows the horrible shit they did. And I don't even like the music that much. And yet it is easier for me to listen to than like music that I love and think is genuinely really good.
Because you don't have that attachment to it.
Yeah, kind of. And I feel like that's something that I still am like sort of trying to figure out. But yeah, I feel like that almost doesn't count as a guilty pleasure. So I don't know. I feel like I don't even have a consistent definition of like what a guilty pleasure is.
Yeah, I mean, like, I give this example all the time, but one of my good friends, she grew up in Tennessee and she has great taste, but every now and again, she'll still bump some This Is How We Roll by Florida Georgia Line because she genuinely did love that.
Yeah, I feel like there's probably like, I listened to like a lot of top 40 stuff when I was in like elementary and middle school. That was like, you know, I had like the radio on in my house all the time, and I loved just like the top 40 station. And there's definitely a lot of that that like holds up. Like I heard, I think it was like a Cascada song in like a supermarket recently. And it wasn't even the big one. It wasn't even Every Time We Touch. I think it was Evacuate the Dance Floor. And I was like, shit, this still goes so hard. Like, this is so fucking good. But there's definitely a lot of stuff from that era that like is not that good. Or stuff where I'm like, is this really good? Or like, did I just like have a lot of fun listening to it in middle school when I didn't sleep or like when I couldn't sleep and I was just like, fuck it, I'm just gonna like hang out in my room with the radio on. So I don't know. I feel like, again, it's kind of getting into questions of objectivity and like, you know, I don't even know what is objectively good or if anything is objectively good or bad.
You know the one thing that is objectively good? Evacuate the dance floor.
Hell yeah. That's true.
I'm bumping that as soon as we log
Yeah.
off.
Yeah.
I
So,
just
or like, I was, do you know that TikTok? I don't know why this is the other thing I thought of, but it's the TikTok of the two girls in sunglasses and like Adidas jackets, and it's like Balkan coffee shops at 8 a.m. and they're playing Stereo Love by Edward Maya, and like the girls playing the baristas are like smoking inside and like, you know, making coffees and dancing and shit. It's so funny. And I feel like every time it comes up on my timeline or I see it, I have to watch the video because I'm just like, okay, maybe TikTok shouldn't be banned. But the song in it used to be on all the time when on the top 40 radio station that I listened to when I was like 12. And I was like, shit, this is still really fucking good. Like, I think they were like a one-hit wonder. It is, you know, I don't know what the lyrics are to this song. It's not in English, but the beat goes fucking stupid. And I was like, yeah, this is still great. Like, so yeah, I think there's stuff that is less definitively good that is like maybe it was just good because I was 13 years old, but I don't know how well I trust myself when it comes to that.
That also like reminds me of you know how you'll go to like a local show or like a medium-sized venue and the PA, the sound guy is always just playing like the most indie obscure dive bar shit of all time. So that happens every time I go to a show, except the one exception is Arlene's Grocery. You go to Arlene's, you know what they're playing over the PA? They're playing Stereo Love. They're playing Mr. Saxo Beat, all the 2008 top Hot 100 bangers.
Mr. Saxo beat. Oh my God. That really unearthed something. Yeah, they're playing fucking Papa Americano. I love that.
And it's just like, yeah, you see how much fun we're having, like talking about quote unquote guilty things? Like, someone needs to write a dissertation, a grad dissertation on like why feeling guilty feels pretty good.
Yeah, well, it's also like I feel like we need some kind of middle ground between the like if you hate X pop star, you just hate fun and you just want everyone to be boring and you're a hater and like poptimism is terrible, pop music is inherently fucking stupid. If you like this, you're also stupid. Which I don't know. I feel like I think that middle ground is, well, there's so much of that middle ground, huge middle ground. And I think it's really like ripe for exploration. And but I feel like especially on the internet, people kind of hate nuance and you know it, you, and I'm guilty of this as well. I love to have like a hard opinion on stuff, but I think there's so much room for like kind of putting all of that into context and being like, okay, well, like, what are the merits of this thing? And also, like, does it have to be hugely culturally important or have some like deep message? Or do we have to like find that in it in order to just be like, no, this is good because it bangs and it slaps and it's fun?
Yeah. There really does need to be like a sort of middle ground, but you could also like make the cynical argument of like the way the internet wires everybody's brains. Is that ever going to be possible to
Yeah.
get grasp some nuance, at
Yeah.
least
Because
just a little
nuance
bit?
doesn't get you clicks.
Exactly. That doesn't get you traffic.
Yeah.
It's so. One of my last like hot button, like hot take questions is, Do you want to tell me a little bit about, because this is genuinely interesting to me, the boy genius paradox that you often talk about?
Yeah, I feel like that is a, I feel like there's such an interesting one because I have been following them both individually and as a group for so long. And I feel like I was like kind of in the Target demo in a weird way because it was like, oh, I was, you know, I'm like a older Gen Z white woman who, you know, listens to a lot of indie music. When they first dropped that EP, I, you know, I was like going to a liberal arts school in the Northeast and I was already a fan of all three of them. And I had like seen, I've seen each member of Boy Genius open for someone else, but I've never seen any of them headline, which I think is very funny. And I've never seen them all together. But yeah, I think I feel like, especially since they've gotten so like mainstream level famous, I feel like they're one of those artists where like the idea of them has kind of overshadowed the music itself. And I think that's, that can be kind of tricky when you're writing about an artist whose reputation precedes them. Like, how do you contextualize their career, but also like talk about the music and not just, and I think like, and I think it's interesting with Boy Genius because the, I found myself getting frustrated with the way that they would be praised a lot of the time. I felt like so much of the coverage of them, and I talked about this in that piece that kind of like I kind of wrote just on a whim and then was like, fuck, I need to put this somewhere. Fuck it, I'm starting a newsletter, I guess, now. And that became the first post, and like it kind of took off. But it's, I feel like a lot of the positive coverage of them is like, oh, they're best friends. And that's like the thing. Like, it's so cool that women can make music and be friends. But like, it's, women are making music and having friends all the time. Like, that's not novel. Like, let's talk about the music. Let's talk about the process, not just like, they're girls with guitars and they're besties, which feels very reductive and like kind of distracting. But also, I don't like when it's this kind of weird thing of like a lot of the, I think a lot of the criticism of them genuinely is sexist. And I think you kind of see this with a lot of times with female artists that have a very dedicated fan base, where it's like, yeah, it, they do experience a lot of misogyny and a lot of like kind of weird gender biases that they would not if they were like cis dude musicians. But like at the same time, like there is a way to criticize them thoughtfully and with validity that isn't misogynistic. But of course, you get kind of like, and I think it happens with Boy Genius. I think like, I, the biggest example I can think of this happening is like Taylor Swift, where it's like, well, if you don't like her music, you hate women or you're sexist, you're just being a misogynist. It's like, well, no, like, I think if we really want to respect women artists, we have to, you know, are, we have to, like, we shouldn't hold them to a standard that is different from male artists. Like, any artist of any gender is not immune to criticism, is, you know, should have their art looked at holistically and thoughtfully. And like, I think it, you know, see that, and this is why I like, I think there's like a real importance to thoughtful negative criticism, because to criticize something positive or negative in a way that is thoughtful, that is analytical, that is, you know, professional, you have to spend a lot of time with it and you have to really pay it attention. And I think there's, I think that's kind of one of the things that, you know, we forget about like critics and about journalists, is that like, if I'm writing about a piece of music, I'm going to give it its due. Like, I'm going to pay a lot of attention to it. I'm going to study it closely. And I'm not just kind of pulling my opinions out of thin air. And I felt like a lot of times people were doing that with Boy Genius, both people who were saying negative things and positive things about it, because the positive a lot of times seemed to overlook there. And of course there were exceptions, but a lot of times it seemed to just be like, okay, well, let's talk about what these artists, or like, if we're being completely honest, what like Phoebe Bridgers represents to me in my mind and what my perception of this famous person is. And then the negative felt just like, I feel like a lot of the negative critiques felt like, again, being like, okay, well, what does this thing represent? What's it a stand-in for something about pop culture that I just don't like? Or like, are my negative criticisms coming from like the fact that their fan bases can be kind of annoying? Are they coming from the fact that like, I think they're sort of cringe or corny? Like, and you know, I think that like calling something corny under certain circumstances can be a very valid critique. But I think my main issue that I took with the way people talked about Boy Genius was kind of the lack of attention, or not, or like the lack of like attention to the music rather than to the idea of the people making it, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense for sure. And why wouldn't we talk about the music? Like, it's damn good music. I remember when the EP came out too. I remember where I was. And it is, yeah, it's like it's a really like complicated sort of phenomena to disentangle, the way that women get talked about, the way that just being quote like famous, and like that you can argue that they're like getting up there of being real
Oh,
famous
yeah.
now, and the way that that can really like fuck with people. Yeah, it's interesting, it's tough, but like I thought that your newsletter piece about it like really put into perspective like the importance of looking at art holistically in any case, regardless of what someone looks like or what gender they were assigned at birth and all that. But I think that might be a good note to end on. So I would like to end by asking you, what does the rest of the year have in store for Grace?
I would love to know. I'm still kind of figuring out what my situation is for this summer, but I am, you know, about a month out from finishing my second year of grad school. And in the fall, I'll be starting my third year, going to be going back to teaching, going to be really working on my thesis, which I'm, you know, already doing, but it's work is going to be really ramping up. I am hoping to keep doing my newsletter. I haven't posted on it in like a month or so, and I want to kind of get back into that groove and keep doing freelance stuff. Kind of just keep doing what I'm doing. Yeah, I don't want to like big things coming too much, but like medium things coming. Yeah.
Amazing. Love it. And imploring all listeners to read your work and your incredible bylines in Paste, in The Alternative, and all the things.
Thank you. Yeah, this has been so much fun.
Thank you for hopping on. I had a blast.
Me too. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much for listening to Sounding Out with Izzy, and thank you to Grace Robin Somerville for joining me today. Remember to subscribe and sign up for the mailing list on my YouTube channel and written blog, both under the name A Girl's Two Sound Sense. Give the podcast a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you so much for listening, and I will catch you in the next episode of Sounding Out with Izzy.